Hello, and welcome to the Locust Roundtable podcast. Today, we're recording with Brian Evanson, who's the chair of the Literary Arts Program at Brown University. He's also the author of novels such as The Open Curtain and Fugue State. We're also joined by Peter Straub, recent winner of the World Fantasy Award for Life Achievement, and author of novels such as Lost Boy, Lost Girl, and most recently, A Dark Matter. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's nice to be here, Karen.
Now, my understanding is that you've both, over time, been involved with a magazine called Conjunctions, and I was wondering maybe if you guys could talk about that a little bit. Brian?
Yeah, I have been involved with Conjunctions for a while now. I'm an editor for them and, have done the website as well. And it's a magazine that, over time, it started as a pretty traditional literary magazine, a pretty traditional innovative literary magazine. And over time, I think we've become more and more interested in crossing boundaries between genres, partly because of an issue that Peter did a few years ago.
And that would be the infamous Conjunction 39?
That's exactly.
And Peter, exactly. How did you come to be involved with that?
Well, I've been a friend of Brad Morrow's for a long time. Bradford Morrow, besides being a novelist, is the founder and editor of Conjunctions and kind of very much his guiding spirit. And he had always sort of liked what I'd done. In fact, he began to like what I was doing more and more. And he was moved to ask me if I thought I could do an issue that would bring in a bunch of writers that perhaps that he didn't know, but were doing innovative things, or at least interesting things in the worlds of fantasy, horror. And at first I said no, and then I started to think about all the great people I could have in it, and I agreed to do it. And it was a joy, really. Brian was in it, and Kelly Link was in it. And the first person who submitted a story was John Crowley. The story was The Girlhood of Shakespeare's Heroines, which is one of the best stories I've ever read. And a very, very beautiful and rather eccentric story, a little bit... A story that seems very much solidly in the mainstream, but gets a little fuzzy around the edges. Anyhow, once Brad read that, because he'd never read a word by Crowley before, and he'd only heard of him from me. Once he read that, he was signed on. He bought the whole program, and he said he would go as far as I wanted to go. And as the stories came in, he became happier and happier.
I agree that Crowley story is a terrific story. Really wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. It's a novella, really. And when John sent it, he said, "Look, I don't think this is a fantasy story at all. But if you want to take it, it's the only story I'm going to write for a long time, probably." And there was no question that we were not going to take it. And it set a tone. We put it in first place in the issue, and it really. Kind of set us up, I think.
I think for me too. I wasn't involved in putting the issue together, but and didn't even see it till it was very close to coming out. But for me as a writer, it was really important just to have, to take something that a magazine that's kind of thought of as being one thing and putting in work that you wouldn't necessarily think would go there, but then realizing that it really goes there marvelously well. And so for me, that was the start of kind of making me reconsider the distinction between genre and literature.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Because your own position, although very private, or very personal, I mean, was entirely literary. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Hence, before that, apart from those peculiar things you did under not quite your name, sword and sorcery, whatever that is.
Right. No, I've played around. I've done some video game novels under B.K. Evanson. Yeah.
B.K. Evanson, right.
Mm-hmm.
anyhow, you fit in beautifully, and once I put you in that company, I sort of automatically thought of you that way. Though, as I said in the introduction to Last Days, I first heard of you from students I had in a master class at Columbia, who gave me your name when I asked them the writers that they like to read. They gave me this long list, and you were among them. And then I bought Altman's Tongue, and I was rather astonished.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
I'd never read work like that before, because there never was work like that before. You know, it's very, very striking stuff. And it can be seen as, you know, to simplify radically, it can be seen as one haiku-like version of dystopia in writing.
Yeah.
With all sorts of other factors overlaid on top of that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for me, I mean, I think some of the authors that you published in that issue have become people who are really very, very well recognized on both sides of the line in terms of thinking about literature and genre. Kelly Link, for instance.
That's right.
Yeah, really respected by both sides. John Crowley, I think, as well, is someone who's very well recognized by both sides of the line.
Mm-hmm. I hope. Well, I often mention Crowley's name in circles where I'm sure it will be recognized, and it just isn't. They're like Donald Harrington before him, though they don't have much else in common. He was undeservedly kind of unread, I think. Crowley should be far more well known than he is.
I agree with that. Yeah,
but there's only so much I can do. But I try to tell good readers and smart people that they would fall in love with his work if they would venture in. Anyhow, who else was there? There was M. John Harrison.
Oh yeah,
that's an amazing story.
Yeah,
China's
in that. I think that was my introduction to Harrison's work, and and China's work is really great as well in that piece, in that issue.
And Liz Hand, who is just a spectacular writer.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. One of our best, I think. I was very happy that she could contribute.
Yeah, I like her work a lot too, and I think that I'm trying to think if I was introduced to her there, but if not, it was very close to that, and that's uh-huh. It made me think very seriously about her. And Gayn Wilson, I think, is in that issue too.
Gayn Wilson did the cover.
Right.
Yeah, he's amazing. Anyhow, I've been involved with conjunctions for 4 or 5 years before that, and I contributed a couple of stories to it. But this is the most Brad ever let me get my hands on it. And he let me shape that issue exactly as I wished, and he was delighted with it. Brad Morrow, I mean, most people who are sort of high-minded and have such exquisite taste as Brad does would not be open to an experiment like that. And it was kind of experimental for him, except insofar as he trusted me. But he didn't know if he could trust any of these other people. But because he trusted me, he opened the gate. And when it was all over, he was ecstatic. He was thrilled. And they sold more issues of that conjunction than of any other. One could also say, of course, because it's a little more popularly inclined than conjunctions normally even wants to be. Brad Morrow's tastes led him to John Hawkes and Robert Coover, to Paul West, to Robert Kelly, to
Lauterbach and
William Gass. And for him to understand how good this work was says a lot about him. He's a very, very good and generous and sensible reader. He's a good editor too.
I think he is, and yeah, I was impressed by. He is really willing to trust people whose taste he, you know, who he admires.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was willing to, I mean, I think probably the majority of people in that issue had never been published in conjunctions before, may not have even heard of conjunctions before,
and then most conjunctions readers had never heard of them. So
right,
if Brad would say, "Look, I'm going to open up my house this weekend. Just invite anybody you like, and tell them they can sleep anywhere they want. They can eat what they want and drink what they like." And I'll come back in 2 or 3 days. it was that degree of trust,
right.
And he found, as I felt that trust had been really wonderfully repaid. The issue did get a lot of attention. The one problem with it, as far as I was concerned, was the title. I knew that I was hoping to put some kind of metaphoric title on it that would refer to a great, hitherto unseen natural phenomenon, and I was trying to think of good metaphors for that, and Brad said, "Oh, I know, we don't want any of that stuff. Well, let's call it the New Wave Fabulists." and I thought, all these science fiction people are going to climb down my throat because they use New Wave in a very specific way, and they're going to be irritated that I act as though I didn't know that or as though I think I could just appropriate it. And that really happened. A lot of people said, "I don't know why it's got this terrible title. I looked for New Wave Fabulous, and I didn't find it. All I found was a bunch of good stories." As though that were not enough, you know? Anyhow.
I was about to say, there are worse things.
Yeah.
I think, too, Peter, I'll say that a lot of the people who you published for the first time in conjunctions in that issue have returned to conjunctions since. I think it actually changed the feel of the magazine in a very interesting and very positive way.
That's right. He liked those people so much, like Liz, like Kelly, like you,
mm-hmm.
like Crowley.
Right, Crowley. China, I think, has been in several too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's really.
Yeah.
He probably had a love affair with James Morrow, on the basis of their last names being the same. That was really. But he did. He flipped for James Morrow.
Yeah, he's published him a lot since. Yeah, he really loved his work, I remember.
Yeah, he's having Morrow come to Bard College to meet his class.
Wow.
I was there last week, and it's charming, really. He has a good class of about 15 to 20 students. They're mostly pretty revved up. They're very lively. You know, they're not afraid to talk. And they're up for whatever you bring to the table. So James Morrow will delight them. It'll be nice for both. Hmm. But anyhow, I was very pleased after having done that. I love the way it turned out. I love the fact that there were a couple of outright imitations of it that were published not long after.
Yeah,
People who acknowledged what they were doing, which was very decent of them. And then about a year later, I did an anthology called Poe's Children with Doubleday, which was very much simply carried on in the spirit of that conjunctions, and to make the same polemical point. Gary Wolfe tells me that every anthology has a polemical point, and it's certainly true of that anthology of mine, and it's the point that you refer to, Brian, that there perhaps is not much of a boundary anymore between this kind of writing and what we call mainstream.
I think that a lot of people, I run across this a lot with students since I teach at Brown, and when I go and travel and read, I think a lot of people have decided in advance that what the difference is, and done so without actually reading work or paying attention to what's really out there.
That's really true. That's very discouraging. But that is, it used to sort of discourage me, and now I'm just kind of used to it. I've done what I can to speak against that idea.
Yeah, I think it has gotten better though too over the last 10 years. I mean, it definitely seems with young students especially, they're a little more open in terms of thinking about, you know, that boundary isn't as firm as some of their teachers think it is, for instance.
So, do you get students at Brown who are interested in genre related work?
We do some. Sometimes in the graduate program, sometimes the undergraduates. There's definitely a range, and they gravitate towards certain people because certain people are open to it, and others are not. But I guess most recently, in terms of graduate school, we had a guy named Brian Kahn here who did Clarion, and really interesting writer, and has a book that is kind of far future science fiction, excellent book I think, which was published by Fiction Collective 2. So kind of what I see as an SF book published by an innovative experimental press.
Yeah. You know, you spoke of this far future science fiction, but I've noticed a lot of very near future work.
Yeah,
written by people who really do not want to be called science fiction writers, and use it as a technique, as a method for being able to describe things in kind of a flattened out, two dimensional way. To make political points or ideological points.
Right. Are you thinking of like George Sanders and people like that?
Well, probably more people who are imitating him. There's a young writer named Shia Scanlon whose work I blurbed. He had the bad luck to be the first and only novel published by Flatman Crooked, which was a journal that was beautiful and published great stuff, but kind of overextended itself when they try to publish books. It's sort of like people who also would imitate the what William Gibson is doing now.
Oh yeah,
and Jennifer Egan, though she doesn't flatten anything out, her work kind of tended in that direction in the last chapter of A Visit from Lagoon Squad.
Ah, interesting.
It's set in the very near future. And most of the marketing is done for infants who have little handheld telephone-like objects. And when they see something advertised on this, or they hear music they like that comes through their device, they point at it and they buy it. And they're therefore referred to as pointers. There are concerts for pointers. They're probably going to be movies for pointers. It's very funny. It's a kind of interesting take on our youth culture and how it gets younger as it goes, dumber and dumber.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. That there is a lot of stuff that it's. It, barely in the future. It seems like, I mean, if it was published by an SF press, then it would be read as SF, and but it's often published by a literary press and read in a very different way.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There's sort of a Dave Eggers feeling to a lot of that work too.
Yeah,
kind of a backing away from feeling.
When it seems like the same thing could be said of fantasy, you're seeing less, perhaps, of the secondary world fantasy, more fantasies that set, you know, in our world, in our time, but, you know, with strange things happening, either, you know, very small portals or you know, instead the breaking through of the fantastic into our world.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
That is not to speak of people like Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. And the world of people that surround them who do deal with mermaids and unicorns and castles and princes, all that's very lively and thriving and probably has gone through all sorts of interesting changes. Only I haven't followed. You know, I like Ellen and Delia a good deal, and I read their short stories, but I'm not really caught up in the, you know, the main thrust of what they're doing or what their comrades are doing. But they speak in the same way. And I mean, they speak of a lowering of the boundaries, only they call it interstitiality. And they have an interstitial arts program. They have a journal.
Yeah, Dora Goss is also involved in that.
Dora Goss is very much in their world. Yeah, that's right. No, I haven't read anything by her. Is she a, would you call her a fantasy writer?
I would tend to. Although, again, yeah, very liminal, very very interstitial.
Okay. Well, that's good, really, isn't it?
Because yeah, she's a beautiful writer. That's the important thing.
Yeah, that is very important. And we don't really need much more Tolkien, you know? We've got a lot of Tolkien now, ever since World War II.
Yeah.
Especially during the 60s. And afterwards, many, many, many Tolkien-esque fantasies. And after a while, it runs out of the same kind of steam that people imitate Raymond Chandler ran out of.
Yeah.
I've read a lot of Private Eye novels set in places like Cleveland, with guys with a sidekick and a you know, not enough money and a gun in the briefcase and a bottle in the desk. And it's like the title of an Elizabeth Hand novel, Generation Loss. It gets thinner and thinner and thinner as it goes along. And you don't much care. The gestures are also familiar. The stance is familiar. And if you don't add anything to it.
Yeah. I completely agree. I've done the same thing with Mysteries, Peter, I get really frustrated with that. Partly because Chandler is so good at it.
Yeah.
He's so distinctive that he's easy to imitate. But
that's right.
The imitations are never nearly as good as him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the imitators are the imitators. I really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but I could.
I think it's really healthy for the life of a genre to have this kind of whatever you want to call it, interference, or, you know, these moments where the walls change or they don't seem as thick as they used to.
Sure.
Cross pollination, I think, can be really good.
It almost has to be good. If there's a danger, it's that the genres will disappear. Gary Wolfe has considered this at length here and there, and the title of his book is called The Evaporation of Genre.
Yeah, or Evaporating Genres, I think.
Evaporating Genres, and you know, it, of course, it won't ever happen, because there are many, many honest, good people who really care about the genres as originally defined, and are perhaps capable of doing original work in them, but who are in love with high fantasy, say. George R. R. Martin must be a great case of this.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly in love with all of that kind of thing, but not following idly along in the footsteps of some previous writer.
Well, Ted Chiang had a great line, actually, this just passed ICFA. Somebody was talking about interstitial writing, and he said, you know, I hear about all this interstitiality, and I just want people to know I am stitial.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't keep him from doing incredibly new and innovative things. He just sees himself as working entirely within a tradition bounded by science fiction, although I don't think anybody else would see him being bounded quite so severely.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, you couldn't define him as anything else either.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, Karen. We've been talking about this issue of work appearing in both sides of, you know, either being considered a literary or genre according to where it appears, and my next book was accepted both by a literary press and by Tor.
Mm.
And I'm bringing out with Tor just because I first of all I'd like to be there, but also I think it changes the conversation for me in a really interesting way to do that.
Yeah,
I bet. Yeah, that must have been an interesting choice.
It was, and I think I terrified my agent by making the choice, but it was okay in the long run.
Well, you better ride him hard, Brian.
I guess I should, yeah.
Try to make him spend a little money on you.
No, it is interesting, the way that the presentation, I mean, you know, what publisher does it come from, what cover does it have, changes the way people talk about books. Before I was a reviewer, I never was sensitive to, you know, publishers, for instance, but now... Now that I am a reviewer, that's absolutely one of the critical pieces of information you look at. Who's the one bringing it out?
Right. And there's a curious thing. I mean, I think Barnes & Noble they put their horror in with the literature. So it's kind of mixed in with fiction and literature.
Okay.
And Borders has it separate. It's kind of set out and apart. And, you know, that's not... It's someone in an office made a decision one day to do that, but it does... create a different sense of what horror's relationship is to,
yeah,
is it separate or is it not?
And it keeps readers away from the book.
Well, that may be true too.
Because if you have to go to the horror section, then you have to go all the way to the back of the store, and you probably have to bend down a little bit in order to see the books.
Yeah,
it doesn't get any respect really.
Mm.
And bookstores, and hasn't for since the 80s.
Yeah.
So I'd always rather be just filed along with William Styron, say.
Yeah.
William Styron or Whitley Strieber. I could be right between them. I'd be all right. Well, you know, people have been talking about this forever, and this conversation will go on forever. it's never because it'll never be decided. It can never really come to an end. As long as somebody's got a book where somebody lives after he's dead, or somebody pulls a gun out of his pocket, these books will always have to be defined one way or the other.
Yeah,
and there will be people jumping up and down on both sides. Eager to claim it.
Yeah.
Do you remember a novel called The Death of the Detective by Mark Smith?
I don't.
It came out, when did it come out? In the end of the 60s. It was a huge production, beautifully done by Knopf. And it was a big, ambitious, modernist, racketing, sort of Saul Bellow-ish novel about a private detective in Chicago, and it was genre busting for sure. I mean, it was everything and more, and it was wildly ambitious, and it made a splash, and then it kind of disappeared. And after that, this author Mark Smith, who was a college professor in Chicago, I think, wrote two quiet, very well-written horror-like novels that had ghosts in them anyhow, and then he disappeared.
Huh.
It's a real pity. I think he wore himself out on the death of the detective. But if you have a place to look for it, you might see if you can find it, because it's...
I will, yeah. Thanks for letting me know.
Mark Smith. I think I used to talk about him with Steve King, who also liked that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. The conversation's been going on for a long time, and there's definitely ebbs and flows to it. I think that sometimes it seems like people are a little more aware and a little more open, and other times it seems like things close down.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think I'm a little more hopeful now than I was 5 or 10 years ago, I guess.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I am too. I'm a lot more hopeful, and in part because of the conjunctions, in part because something seemed to happen in the way my own work was being received.
Yeah.
It seemed to be, it and I seemed to be being considered in a more inclusive, more generous manner than before. Which did not at all mean I was selling more books, because I wasn't. but it seemed to be appreciated more.
Right.
Would the critical acclaim always translated to sales dollars?
Well, yeah. I'm not going to complain, I'll tell you that. Anyhow, it's that personally, in a narcissistic way, of course, that's very gratifying. But it has to mean that it's extended beyond me, that it connects. Stephen King, for example, has been treated, he's been fed caviar and champagne by critics for at least a decade now. Mm-hmm. They just gave up. They said, okay, we get it, we know he's good. In fact, sometimes he's really, really good, and they found a way to approve of his subject matter, which is to say, this man understands what frightens us.
Mm.
Yeah. And this makes him a very valuable and valid writer of fiction.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of opened the door, too, I think.
Now, Brian, you've seen a lot of the academic side of the field from the inside. I've always wondered, does it feel, or is this just an out, you know, how it looks from the outside, that sometimes it simply takes maybe a decade or maybe a generation for almost, it seems like, for the academic fields to catch up with what the, you know, sort of publishing waves are?
I think it does take a while for everything to catch up, and you know, I don't know if they always catch up perfectly either. I think that I'll give you, when I was first at Brown, which was 7.5 years ago, I was helping on a search they were doing for an Americanist, and I would say 40% of the dissertations were on Pynchon and kind of contemporary American was what they were looking for, and you know, almost everyone was writing on books from the 70s, and one or two people were writing on David Foster Wallace, a lot of people were writing on people like Bellow. But in terms of people who'd published for the first time in the last 20 years, there was almost nobody. And so I do think it does take some time. I don't know why that's the case or why it should be the case. I mean, I think it would be much, you know, it's there's no reason that academia has to be so stodgy about those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely notice it. Our creative writing program is separate from the English department, and there is something of a divide there where that the work that we're teaching and interested in is not always the same as the work that's being taught as contemporary fiction or literature. I mean, there's a pretty standard canon. Yeah,
absolutely. The English department I know best is the one at the University of Wisconsin, where I was an undergraduate, and then was invited back as a visitor. Both Susan and I were visitors to the English department there, and I liked a great many of those English professors a lot, and they were all very intelligent, and mm-hmm. they're by and large really interesting people. It was very good to hang out with, but there was a wall between them and the creative writing people, and one part of that wall was built of dislike and distrust. They simply didn't want the existence of these other people to impinge on them at all. At some level, it must have made them feel insecure or undermined. It must have made them feel as though somebody somewhere might sometime whisper that there are a few other writers they ought to read, which would cause panic. You know. Uh-huh. But it kind of surprised me. But I've heard that it's true in a great many places. That the department looks down on the creative writing department.
I think that's often the case, and it can also go the other way too, where creative writers sometimes say, oh, I have no need for anything written before 1970. and that, I think, that's another problem. I mean, I think that you can have a great conversation with people as long as you're kind of exchanging ideas and books and, you know, even if the fields are different. And that distrust doesn't necessarily have to be there as long as there's, you know, openness on both sides.
Yeah, well, that sounds very good. I was at a party at my daughter's apartment in Madison when she was in the MFA program there, and I met a young woman who was a little older than the general run of MFA students in that year. She'd actually had a job somewhere in New Mexico before coming, and I said, "Are you one of the poets or one of the fiction people?" She said, "Oh, I'm a poet," and I said, "Oh, good. Who do you like?" And then she named all the people, beginning with Lorraine Niedeker, which I thought was very nice. And I said, do you know Thomas Wyatt? And she gave me this blank look. And I said, come on, I know you know this. You must know the poem that begins, "They flee from me that sometimes you see naked foot stalking in my chamber." And she said, "No, I never heard of that at all."
Oh, wow.
No. It was all wrong. So I just assumed that if you're a poet, you would have got there. You know?
Yeah.
Stupid me.
And here, I mean, at Brown, there's been some interesting things at Brown that have made things a little different. One is that Keith Waldrop is here, and Keith reads incredibly widely, and so tries to expose the students to all sorts of things.
Oh, that's good.
And another is just the fact that we live in Lovecraft's hometown, makes it so Lovecraft, who I think, you know, in most creative writing programs would be treated with contempt, is kind of revered here.
Oh, that's astounding. And also his papers are there in the library.
Yeah, there's an amazing set of papers that are here.
I contributed $500 to a big rock with a plaque on it, somewhere on the campus.
Yeah, right by the library. It's nice.
Well, that makes Brown unique. If Lovecraft had gone to college, if he hadn't had nervous breakdowns in high school, he would have gone to Brown for sure.
Yeah.
It would have been different.
Yeah. I have to admit, the next time I'm in New England, I will make every attempt to get down to the Brown campus. I've had friends who've gone there, but I've never actually visited.
Yeah. If you make it here, just call me and I'll take you to Lovecraft's grave.
It's funny, Lovecraft is one of those authors that I always assumed I wouldn't like until I was educating myself in the sort of history of the genre. I was like, well, okay, I've got to read some Lovecraft.
And I didn't know it, yeah.
I found myself a lot more interested in what he was writing than I expected I would.
Yeah, he's far from perfect, but there's interesting things about his work all the way through, I think.
I'd read Lovecraft when we were in London in the 70s. And some of it gave me a kind of a cheap thrill, as it had when I was like 12, and I read a bunch of Lovecraft stories, but I thought after that that the stylistic excesses really turned me off. Until the Library of America asked me to edit their Lovecraft volume, which came as a real surprise to me. Because I thought there was somebody else who was jumping up and down and saying, me, me, me. Anyhow, they did ask me, and which compelled me to reread a great deal of Lovecraft. And that time around, I was surprised. It wasn't as purple as I thought. And a lot of the stories that had really turned me off, it turned out, were not written by Lovecraft. He'd written a couple of sentences, and August Derleth had written the rest.
Ah,
August Derleth did a lot to spike Lovecraft's reputation by imitating his worst successes.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Anyhow, I found a lot of stuff that was very surprising, and there's a real movement in Lovecraft's work. It changes. It evolves over time. It becomes much more reflective, kind of much more melancholy.
Yeah.
It was almost not completely down the line politically conservative. So by the time you get to the Mountains of Madness, the great old ones might have been vague socialists, you know. And they were kindly and well educated. I mean, they were smart. They weren't just ravenous and angry. It was nice. I thought it was. He did change as he grew up.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was surprised. I mean, I hadn't read Lovecraft for a long time, and then came to Providence for a conference maybe 10 years before I moved here, and saw the papers in the library and started reading him. And I mean, it is certainly a moment's purple, but not as purple as I remembered. I think that's the experience, Peter.
Yeah.
And I do love at the Mountains of Madness. I really still love quite a bit as a
story.
Yeah,
it's very, very reflective. Somebody's making a movie of it, aren't they, with Johnny Depp?
I've heard there's a movie. I didn't know it was going to be with Johnny Depp.
I had seen a movie trailer for it, and then I had heard that it had been canceled, and so I'm still not sure what the status of that project is, because the movie trailer looked like, oh, this is all done, we're just putting the last bit of effects on, and it'll be out this summer, so I'm not sure what the latest word is on that.
I wonder. Yeah, it could be they pull a plug.
Mm.
Well,
it's a shame. It was Guillermo del Toro, which, if I were to ask to see anybody's version of Lovecraft, it would probably be his.
Yeah. He'd be good, all right. That's right. Well, anyhow, I was talking to somebody the other night, somebody well-read. It's a famous actor, and I won't give his name. we were at the same little apartment for brunch the other day, and I mentioned Lovecraft to him, and he said, "Who?" I said, "Lovecraft, of course you know H.P. Lovecraft." He said, "Well, no, I never heard of him." So, the world is not essentially paying a great deal of attention to us.
No, that may be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, many, many more people know about Angry Birds than
Rebecca Black.
Yeah, it always amuses me a little bit when I hear, you know, science fiction and fantasy almost dismissed as, oh, well, the popular genres. I'm like, I wish.
That's really ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
People assume that those guys are making a lot of money. And if they should come to ICFA and hang out.
Something Peter was saying earlier when he's... I mean, I do think you're right, Peter, that they're... you know, a lot of people who have been doing this border crossing for a long time, both in, you know, in mystery and SF and horror and in literature as well. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking a little bit about Gene Wolfe.
Yeah.
I read pretty recently Pandora by Holly Hollander.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Oh, it's a very strange book, and I think a lot of Wolf's books do this thing where they're kind of science fiction. I mean, you can there are markers that are in there, but there are other things going on that almost make them seem like they're, you know, a 30s film or something.
Uh-huh.
And yeah.
Sometimes he's Nabokovian.
Yeah.
They're little games and little secrets and things hidden and things in disguise.
Yeah,
and you know, Wolf loves that. He cherishes doing that, and he's challenging you to find it, whatever it is.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, I definitely see that in his work, and you know, and a number of other people as well, or, you know, the kind of complexity you get in some of Samuel Delaney's work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm very fond of Gene Wolfe, and I think Gene Wolfe is unknown outside of our community.
I think you're right. Yeah,
I've never heard anybody else refer to his works. I've never seen another sort of person carry his books. Read them in public. I don't think I've ever seen a Gene Wolfe novel reviewed in the Times, for example. He's reviewed in Publishers Weekly.
Yeah,
because they have room. They make space for lots of different kinds of writers. And yet I think Gene Wolfe is exactly where he wants to be.
Yeah.
You know, he's reached the people he wants to reach, and I think he's delighted, he's overjoyed to have reached them.
Yeah.
It means an immense amount to him.
Yeah. He was in that conjunction to this year you did as well, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was suspicious of me, and when I asked him for a story, first he dithered for a while, and he didn't get back to me, and then he sent me a handwritten letter, because he doesn't use email, saying he was going to decline because I'd waited so long to ask him in that he thought I didn't really want him in there at all anyhow. At this point, I groaned, and I wrote him back, and I got no answer. And then I was grousing to David Hartwell about this, and Hartwell's his editor. So David very much wanted something of Gene's to be in that Conjunctions issue, and he said, "You're going to do an excerpt from the books he's doing now," and that was Wizard and Knight. And he said, "I'll find something for you." And so he sent me a freestanding little slab of about 30 to 50 pages that read like it read like stream water. I mean, it just went down. It was there were no obvious complexities or subtleties in there at all, except that it was beautifully written in this absolutely accessible way.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, there's undoubtedly other things going on beneath the surface here, but this is really good enough. And so I think Gene was actually pleased.
You know? Oh, that's good.
It's like the way he left that clarion when some student insulted him. You recall this?
I don't know about this.
I've not heard that story.
He drove out. I think it was Clarion. It was. If there's another one, it might have been the other one. He was. People wanted him to be there. He drove from his Barrington, Illinois, you know, a long way to where this Clarion was. He unpacked the car, and he drove straight to the classes. And some student, not quite in his or her right mind, attacked Gene in class. And he didn't know that this person was not a typical Clarion student. And he didn't know that this person was a bit disturbed. And so he was shocked at this behavior. And he turned around, he drove back to the house, he packed his car up, and he drove back to Illinois. So he does not want resistance, you know. He does not want to be, at his age, I think, he doesn't need extra trouble.
Well, and his accomplishments are such at this point, he probably doesn't deserve to have much resistance.
No, exactly. Yeah, with everything he's done.
Yeah.
He deserves to be treated well. And anyhow, he was glad to be in that book. And I don't think I ever did quite crack the secret code to Wizard Knight.
I know. I never felt like I quite got the key to it when I read it.
Yeah, but it's sure as fun to read, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Mark Twain or something. It's really cool.
Yeah.
I wonder if Gene's reputation wouldn't be different if he started in the last 10 years or so, because I'm thinking that now we live in a world where Kelly Link's you know, reviewed in Time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be, but I also think that he was one of the people that has made it possible for these other people to be reviewed in Time. So
he's the giant whose shoulders they're standing on?
Well, there's, I mean, I think everyone is always in a little bit of an unfortunate position of being the person who comes before the, you know, anyone who's doing innovative work or crossing a boundary, if it hasn't been repeatedly crossed before, I mean, I think you risk being the person whose shoulders the other people stand on and very easily get across that.
Yeah. It reminds me of a tenor saxophone player, Lester Young, who was a great, great player and was quite famous in his lifetime, but died far too young. But in his decline, he'd watch musicians who imitated him, who were walking the jazz clubs, where they were working, where they were earning a lot of money. And he said to somebody, he said, "All the other ladies are making all the money." And they were absolutely standing on his shoulders. Because when a thing passes through someone else's digestive system, it's always smoothed out a little bit. You know, it's always made a little more accessible.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Or it opens the, you know, you have to have something to come and kind of open the way a little bit and break the resistance down a little, and then the next thing slides right through.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, in the generation currently cooking, I think Kelly Link, as they say, carries a lot of water. I think she has done an immense amount simply by doing the best work she can to bring innovative, fantastic writing up into a public viewpoint, public view. And to make it more acceptable.
Well, and what she and Gavin Grant have done with Small Beer Press too.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
they brought an enormous number of other people along behind them. I always like that generosity in success.
I do too. I really admire Kelly and what she's doing, and I think Small Beer is doing wonderful things as well.
Right. And it's nice that when one begins to speak about this with people who don't know a lot, a great many of them know Kelly's work.
Yeah.
Because she gets reviewed in Time magazine. She gets reviewed all over the place, Esquire. People know she's so good that people can't ignore it, really. I think it's terrific. And what she's doing is so great.
Yeah.
I'm glad also that she resisted what must have been very, very loud voices saying, "Write a novel, write a novel, write a novel." Because anybody like Kelly is advised as strongly as possible to write a novel as early as possible.
Yeah.
Once I read her first book of stories, I said, "Don't let anybody push you into writing a novel." I didn't know that Kelly didn't need anybody's advice about not letting herself get pushed around. She stuck to her last, you know, unblinkingly, unflinchingly, without a second thought, I think.
Yeah, no, she's a wonderful story writer, I agree. And I'm glad she hasn't given into that impulse to expand a story into a novel. Or
One day she'll have really bad luck and she'll have a really cool idea for a novel. and then 2 years are going to be ruined because she won't be able to do anything else. You'll have to sit there like we do, and you know, grind it out. Anyhow, I would very much want to read that novel.
Yeah.
Once she gets there.
Yeah.
Or maybe she never will. I mean, she certainly need not. I'm to say that is a banality, but that's really true.
And I think she's very good at long, almost novella-length stories as well. I mean, she is.
That's right.
She does at times seem like she's moving towards larger.
Stone Animals. It's an astonishing story, and it's 50, 60 pages long.
Right.
I read another long story too. fairly recently. Oh, I can't remember. It seemed very, it was very despairing kind of a story.
Yeah, I don't know offhand, but it would be.
I don't know. I saw it at some convention not long after I read it, and I said, there's a lot of despair in that story, isn't there? And she said, yes, Peter. And she said it very kindly.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's probably a good place to wrap it up. We've been talking for about an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. Excellent. The traditional ending is to give you guys a chance to let people know what sort of work that you've got coming out, either recently or forthcoming. Brian, you mentioned that you might have something coming out from Tor soon.
I have something coming out, yeah, a novel from Tor called Immobility, mm-hmm. which is coming out in, it won't be out till 2012 sometime.
Okay. And Peter?
All I have coming out is a fairly long story in the upcoming spring issue of Conjunctions. It's called The Ballad of Ballard and Sandrine. And it's I wrote it over the first 2 months of this year, and it's the first thing I've written since The Dark Matter, and I was very pleased with it. It isn't exactly like anything I wrote before, and so I was kind of absurdly happy with it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm returning to the novel that was kind of on my desk before I was distracted by this novella. And I won't be done with that for 2 years probably, and it has a working title, but I better not say what that because it's too silly, the working title. Anyhow, Karen, thank you. This is great.
Thanks very much, Karen.
Yes, thank you both for coming.